Thanks, Denise. Well, as you heard, Ian Urquhart is a professor of political science at University of Alberta, co-author of The Last Great Forest, Japanese Multinationals and Alberta's Northern Forests, the former editor of the Wildlands Advocate, the Alberta Wilderness Association's news journal, and the subject of our discussion today, the recent and important book he authored, Costly Fix, Power, Politics, and Nature in the Tar Sands. Welcome to KABU, Ian.
Oh, thanks. Thanks very much, Lori. It's a real honor to be part of this wonderful radio station this morning.
Thanks. Well, okay, so since most of us here look north to Canada for examples of sanity, clearly, as your book Costly Fix identifies, there the oil industry and elected officials are together hastening the global climate disaster. Let's start with what happened in the 1990s when the Canadian state began to support tar sands expansion. Why did it?
It's a fundamental question, and I think that actually what was taking place in Canada and Alberta in the 1990s was really a version of what we saw in other jurisdictions around the world. We saw it in Thatcher's United Kingdom. We saw it in Reagan's America. And I think what we really saw happening at that particular time was how a particular idea becomes embedded in political institutions, as well as in mainstream political parties and the groups who want to influence government, and that it becomes obvious to this particular idea what position government should take relative to an industry like the petroleum industry. The idea, that the phrase that I use in the book is market fundamentalism, which comes from Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel-winning economist. And Stiglitz describes market fundamentalism as really being the prevailing religion in the West for at least a generation now. And I think he's absolutely right about that. And what happened in Alberta and in the U.S., people like Fred Block and Margaret Summers have examined this market fundamentalism phenomenon in the U.S. And what happened in Canada and in Alberta was, to some extent, a deregulation of markets, what we associate with neoliberalism. But there was also a very important re-regulation that went on at this particular time. And this was a re-regulation that essentially made it much more profitable for the tar sands principals to engage in that particular type of very ecologically destructive petroleum extraction.
Well, let's talk about this market fundamentalism, because even though its proponents and its propaganda would like us to imagine that it's the free market at work,
right,
as your book points out, it's the state and state intervention that makes this profiteering possible. So tell us more about that in relation to the tar sands context.
Sure, absolutely. And it is that notion of of re-regulation that is so important. So what we had in Canada in the 1980s was an industry in its infancy that, contrary to the conventional wisdom in the business press, was actually quite profitable. But what we had happen in the 1990s was a right-of-center government come to power in Alberta that essentially saw no value in the resource other than trying to accelerate its development as quickly as possible. We saw a failure on the part of government to realize that in those times it had important bargaining chips that it could have been employed against the petroleum industry, political stability. Look at Venezuela, an educated, trained labor force, access to the U.S. market, those sorts of things. But this notion that the state should really be the servant of industry was, it became the norm, not only in the right of center parties, but even among the center left parties like the New Democrats and the Liberals. The notion that they should support industry, try to increase their profitability. We see it now. I mean, this notion of re-regulation is something that we're seeing today, where, what does the Canadian government do with respect to tar sands production? Well, we run out and buy a pipeline for over $4 billion, even in Canadian dollars. That's an impressive piece of change. What do? We curtail oil production in order to try to make the industry more profitable than it otherwise would be. The Premier of Alberta has announced that she wants to buy over $1 billion in rail cars to, again, what's the point of that? It's to support the industry. So we've lived in this time for going on a generation now.
Well, of course, just the fact that the NDP is behaving this way is very disappointing for our American listeners. The New Democratic Party in Canada represents the left of center party, left of the Democratic Party in the U.S., and yet it is also embracing this kind of market fundamentalism. So how did the petroleum or fossil fuels industries, how did they capture Canadian government at the provincial and federal levels?
Yeah, like in terms, it would be a mistake for me to suggest that the history of oil in Canada as a history where we've seen government standing up to the oil industry. I mean, that hasn't been the case. So the sort of exceptional boom that began in the 1990s was to some degree a continuation or an exaggeration of what had existed previously in Canada. But importantly, in the 1970s, we had at the provincial level and at the federal level, we had governments that were prepared to challenge industry over questions like, what share of natural resource wealth should private corporations get relative to the public treasury? So we had that. We had that taking place in the 1970s and the early part of the 1980s. But since that point of time, those sorts of views have vanished from the mainstream political spectrum in Canada. As you pointed out, we have a left of center provincial government here in Alberta that has really behaved exactly as its predecessors, its more conservative administrations, more Republican like administrations, behaved in the 1980s, 90s, and first decade of this century.
Well, that's kind of a depressing reality. This market fundamentalism's hegemonic control over all political parties. But I don't think, I think you show there's evidence that not everyone has bought into this because, of course, Trudeau campaigned in 2015 on this promise of curtailing the pipeline that Kinder Morgan was proposing. And then, as you show, he ends up spending Canadian dollars to purchase it.
Right. Well, I mean, I think one lesson from all of this, and this is for my American friends as well as people in this country, is one of the things we really like in terms of thinking about as an activist. I mean, how are we going to deal with this? How are we going to deal with this situation? I think the first step is whether you want to be involved in formal party politics or politics outside of mainstream political parties, I think the first thing that you have to do is be skeptical of just about everything the government tells you. The now infamous phrase "fake news." This is something that government more often than not is responsible for, not newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post, etc. So I think that in sort of thinking, well, what do we do with these sorts of situations? One of the ways we should try to address it is in our skepticism. Other ways that we have to try to identify and follow are identifying those sorts of institutional settings where it's possible to express these voices in a way that have real meaning. One of the things, for example, that was important in the opposition to the tar sands was the debate over Keystone XL in the U.S. during the Obama administration. And activists who were concerned about what's being done to the planet through tar sands were able to use features of the American political system in a way to at least temporarily block that particular project. So I think one of the things I think we have to do is try to identify settings where constructive critical voices can be heard and try to institutionalize those voices in those processes. Because otherwise, if we, I sincerely believe that if we leave this to mainstream political parties, both north of the 49th parallel and south of the 49th parallel, we're just in for same old until we ultimately hit some sort of terrible crisis down the road.
Well, let's talk about what activists have been doing, because certainly First Nations and environmental groups have been pushing back, not only in Alberta, but British Columbia is also key to this effort to not only expand the pipeline, because the tar sands have to find markets for that horrible crude oil that actually uses more energy than it produces, right?
Right.
So what has been happening there in terms of pushing back and seeking some of these places that you describe?
Well, I think in terms of what's really crucial to recognize here, Laurie, is that when you talk about British Columbia, you're talking about an environmental group and a considerable portion of First Nations who don't have a material interest in, who aren't being subsidized, for example, by big oil. And so I think there's a huge qualitative difference in Canada between the opposition we see in British Columbia and the sort of opposition we see in Alberta, and it's intimately related to how tight the connections are between the oil industry and First Nations and environmentalists. So in British Columbia, for example, you have the provincial government is pursuing what unfortunately I think will be an unsuccessful court case to try to derail the pipeline expansion. We've seen, in addition, organizations like Greenpeace, for example, shift their organizing out of a place like Alberta into British Columbia in order to try to mobilize the public in places like Burnaby and Vancouver to oppose these developments.
Yes, what about First Nations groups in particular? And were you about to contrast First Nations groups in Alberta and British Columbia?
Yeah, the First Nations picture is a much more complicated one in Canada, at any rate, and I can't speak for the U.S. particularly well at all, but is a much more complicated picture than I think the conventional wisdom is. And what I mean by that is one of the things that I wrote about in the book is there are certainly within First Nations communities in northeastern Alberta important environmental human health objections that First Nations have been raising for years and years and years about tar sands development in northeastern Alberta. But there's also an important element in those constituencies that seeks a better material life. And imagine you're in Portland. So imagine if in Vancouver on the other side of the river, a big tar sands plant gets created. And then to the east of Portland, another tar sands plant gets created. And similarly to the south. And you're sitting there in your community and you're wondering, well, what are my development prospects? I mean, how do I make a better life for my family, my children? Many in that part of Alberta have actually turned and have become principals in exploiting the tar sands in northeastern Alberta. And they've essentially been caught between a rock and a hard place. You know, colonial settler society decided that this was going to be the pattern of development that was going to take place in these places. And First Nations have had the difficult choice of deciding, do we oppose that or do we try to accommodate that in terms of trying to improve our material conditions to the best possible?
Right.
Now, in British Columbia, you don't see the same. There isn't that connection in British Columbia.
Which is why your suggestion for sort of moving the battle outside of Alberta makes sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely it does.
Well, Ian Urquhart, thank you so much for joining us today. And I want to remind listeners that your book, Costly Fix, Power, Politics, and Nature in the Tar Sands, is widely available, and we recommend that you pick it up. It's an important read. Thanks again, Ian Urquhart.
Thanks very much, Lori. It's been a real pleasure.
My daddy was a brakeman in Pullman in the strike of 94. He never knew nothing about the union, but he started learning when they hit that door. Well, he gave him a hot foot and he took to the road, organized the central line. He'd set me on his knee and he would say to me, and I see him from time to time, you got to roll, 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 roll with the union. You got to roll, 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 roll on with the wind. Show the folks how to tell.